With only a handful of remaining legislative days on their calendar, this Congress is on track to go down as one of the most unproductive in modern history. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This Politics Wednesday, we'll be looking at an interesting mix of domestic and international politics with our analysts from Iowa State University, Jim McCormick and Stefan Schmidt. We'll ask whether Congress's relative unproductivity is likely to continue into 2014 and what that might mean for the November elections. Also, now that healthcare.gov is working reasonably well, how much of a fight with Republicans does the White House still have on its hands? Lots to talk about. Join our discussion after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived. We're so glad it has. It brightens up a rather gloomy landscape across Iowa on this December 4th. Joining us in our Ames studio, two of our political analysts from Iowa State University. Jim McCormick is with us, professor and chair of political science at ISU, as well as Stefan Schmidt, university professor of political science at ISU. Stefan, Jim, welcome to Politics Wednesday.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
And we hope to make it an even gloomier day with the topics that we've been assigned today. So let's roll.
Let's roll. A little later in the program, we want to ask about whether Congress's relative unproductivity, unproductivity is likely to continue into 2014, what it might mean for the November elections. And also, now that healthcare.gov is working reasonably well, how much of a fight is still happening or would likely happen between the White House and Republicans. And also an interesting article. We want to have you talk a little bit about ideas you brought up, Stefan Schmidt, have to do with the Confederacy. Harking back to the Confederacy. What does our times have to do with the Confederacy? We'll find out later. Have Stefan talk about that a little bit. But if we could, gentlemen, let's start abroad. International politics in our world as they affect us here at home. Vice President Joe Biden opening a two-day visit to China today by urging young Chinese students to challenge their government, their teachers, their religious leaders. And the vice president's visit comes at a tense moment for the U.S. and China. They are at odds over Beijing's recent insistence that pilots flying through airspace over a set of disputed islands file flight plans with China's government. Here's the vice president speaking yesterday in Tokyo. He was standing side by side with the Japanese prime minister.
Today, as the prime minister mentioned, we discussed China's sudden announcement of a new air defense identification zone. We, the United States, are deeply concerned by the attempt to unilaterally change the status quo in the East China Sea. This action has raised regional tensions and increased the risk of accidents and miscalculation. We are closely consulting with our allies on this matter here in Japan and in Korea. I will be raising these concerns with great specificity directly when I meet with the Chinese leadership.
Okay, Vice President Joe Biden there yesterday with the Japanese Prime Minister. He is in China today, assuming at some point today will be those concerns will be raised. Jim McCormick, can you give us some background on this dispute and tell us what set it off a few days ago?
Well, the issue is in over the East China Sea area, which there are conflicting claims on some islands, Shikoku Island, and the Chinese have a different name for it, that Japanese have claimed for some time. The importance of these islands is less in terms of the kind of rocks that they elicit, but more the minerals that might be in the seabed. So I think that there is this competition for these kind of scarce resources. I think there also is a larger question, particularly with the new Chinese president, and that is to sort of assert Chinese sovereignty in the East Asian area here. And I think that also comes into play here. Now, it's not only Japan that has been in conflict with the Chinese in the East Asia Sea area. It's also been Vietnam and southward in terms of the South China Sea, where the Philippines have also been contesting over some islands. So these are this setting up this identification zone is partially to put into place, it seems to me, or to legitimize some of their claims to these territories.
Mm-hmm. What is the U.S.'s main concern here, specifically in regards to this airspace that is now being claimed by China that, sure, you can fly through it, but we have to know about it. You'll file a flight plan with the Chinese government.
Well, one of the strategies of the Chinese has been over time, and one of their longer-term goals at present, is to gain access or control over so-called the first island chain. And that is, if you sort of picture a map of Northeast Asia, it's from sort of Taiwan south, and that's considered the kind of the first island chain. And Chinese foreign policy has seemingly had as its sort of first goal is to deny access to the United States and its allies as a way of asserting sovereignty. The longer-term goal is sort of the second island chain all the way out to Guam. And so it's sort of a very ambitious and you might say a very assertive or even might say aggressive kind of foreign policy aim of the Chinese long-term. The implications for this for the United States, of course, is to exclude the United States from this area. And, you know, that given that our principal allies of Japan and Korea fall within this first island chain. But the more immediate one, of course, is Taiwan, which the United States has, even though the treaty has been formally abrogated with Taiwan, we still have the so-called Taiwan Relations Act, which mm-hmm. more or less says the United States will come to the defense of Taiwan.
See, a resolution on the horizon or further escalation?
The United States for some time now, and going back to Secretary of State Clinton, has called for a diplomatic solution, usually through the bodies that are in the area, ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and there's also the ASEAN Regional Forum, which has some outside powers. And that is the, if you will, the arena where they'd like to be resolved as well as bilaterally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Stefan Schmidt, how do you see this flare-up on the international scene?
What else is new? Kimoi and Matsu. I'm an old guy. I remember the Chinese having all kinds of battles over the legitimacy of Taiwan in the first place, and then, if not so much Taiwan, all these little islands that border on the Chinese coast. So there have been other disputes between Russia and Japan over little islands in that area and who controls them. It's geopolitics, you know, at its very best. And as Professor McCormick just suggested or said, and I'll go even a little further, there is an incipient and growing power struggle between China and the United States over who is a stronger superpower. And these are all pieces in the chess game of trying to establish that Chinese credibility as a superpower.
Mm-hmm. Chinese undisputed that their economy is surging and has been for many years, but militarily, they are not in the same class as the United States, are they?
They aspire to be. I mean, that their intent is to pre-position themselves to have bases and access deep into the Pacific they've got a ridiculous aircraft carrier, but at least they have one aircraft carrier. And their intent is to build up all of that muscle so that they become a contender in the geopolitical and military part of the global struggle over who dictates, who controls the United Nations, who is, the friend and the power that African and Latin American and other countries relate to. And this is all part of a wedge effort to wedge themselves in where the United States used to be a hegemon. And that's why Obama has this new concept. I mean, the Obama foreign policy, if there is one, is essentially to shift to the Pacific and to rebuild a lot of the bases that were abandoned, to fortify some of the military facilities that are in the Pacific that are now very vulnerable to Chinese missiles. I mean, you may say that China is not rival to the United States, but the Chinese have missiles that can hit every U.S. military facility in the Pacific. And the U.S. Defense Department is highly alarmed and has just requested a huge chunk of money to basically fortify and harden fuel facilities, airplane storage, hangars and so on, which are now exposed basically to potential Chinese attacks. And so this is this is not about some rocks, you know, and whether Japan or China owns them or not. This is, this is a typical game of raising the ante and upping the ante, and the Chinese have done a great job of mm-hmm. that.
Before we move from the East China Sea to another point on the globe, do you have anything to add to that, Jim McCormick?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a couple things and probably ought to mention. You know, about 40% of the world's trade actually goes through this area as well. So it's really critical in terms of maintaining this kind of open access here. And then if you even go further on, you might even get up to 60% in terms of as you get into the Indian Ocean. And, you know, if China could gain, if you will, some hegemony or some dominance there, that obviously would be very telling for the global economy here and their effect on the global economy here. I think the other thing to mention, I would just add one thing to what Stefan said, and that is not only is there the concern from the American point of view with this sort of Asian pivot, which was just put into place or at least formally announced in 2012 in January, there's also the concern about cyber warfare. Because the American Navy particularly relies so heavily on satellites and that kind of communication, if in fact the Chinese could develop this kind of cyber warfare, this would really get to their anti-access kind of goal that some have imputed to the Chinese.
Okay. Join our political discussion, Politics Wednesday, with Jim McCormick and Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. What concerns abroad are catching your attention here at home? Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio also on Facebook. We'd love to have you friend us there. And you could also tweet us at IPR Talk with your comment or question. Let's shift over. I guess we're going westward to Eastern, not Eastern Europe, but Asia, to Ukraine. The opposition failing to oust the government in Ukraine in a no-confidence vote yesterday. Hundreds of thousands have been protesting in this country. Once part of Russia, part of Russia and its communist incarnation, the Soviet Union, many of us remember. Tell us, Jim, what's going on there?
Well, the latest flare-up, of course, is over the at least what was thought to be in line to be signed in Lithuania, an agreement between Ukraine and the EU for basically an association pact with presumably eventually leading to incorporation into the EU. And at the last moment, the Ukrainian president pulled back. Frankly, I think it's without any exaggeration, it's under the threats from Russia in terms of imposing sanctions on trade between Ukraine and Russia. And given the dire state of the Ukrainian economy, it was perceived as crucial not to turn west but to turn back east. In terms of preserving the economy, if at all possible, and at least any kind of punitive action from Russia.
Well, explain a little bit why Ukraine is torn between the two sides, between facing the EU, facing the West, and facing back to its old partner in the Soviet Union, Russia. Is it merely a threat from Russia, or is that enticing as well? Why can't they just develop?
I think geopolitics makes a difference here. If you look mm-hmm. at a map, it's been called, and I like this description, Ukraine is really a pivot state in Central Europe. And if it turns westward, you know, that really exposes, if you will, Russia. Russia, of course, historically has always been concerned about having, if you will, soft states on its borders here, and it obviously has lost some of that. Mm-hmm. But even after the fall of the Soviet Union, you might remember immediately there was sort of the assertion of the so-called near abroad policy. And Putin, of course, has taken this even a step further in terms of reigniting this kind of near abroad policy to try to preserve and promote Russian influence to secure its borders and also this crucial state of Ukraine sort of geographically from turning too much westward, although certainly, as we saw from all the demonstrations and from most of the public view, there's great sympathy for turning to the West.
Stephen Schmidt, we mentioned the hundreds of thousands of protesting. We've seen people power successful in other parts of the globe, most notably in our Arab Spring uprising over the past few years. But do you see chances for success by the opposition? Will they be able to create and sustain enough people power? Will it matter?
Some years ago when they had elections in Ukraine, we did a radio show here where I'm sitting right now. And I pointed out at the time that Ukraine is really not one country. It's really two countries. The eastern part of Ukraine, most of the people are Russian. They are very, very hardcore conservative communists, a lot of coal miners and other really tough people, not very modern, not very urban. And the western part of Ukraine is very European. And besides the geopolitics of the Russians, this is a real cultural cleavage within the Ukraine itself, between Western-oriented Ukrainians who despise the Russians and the Soviet Union before that, and the Eastern ones who were very happy being part of the Soviet Union. So that besides the external factors, this is a country that is deeply, deeply divided, and it probably ought to split into two, and one of them ought to go west, and the other one ought to go east and maybe reincorporate in the Soviet Union, which is or Russia. It's Russia and the Soviet Union are not that different with Putin in power again. Mm-hmm. And so that I don't see any solution to it whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I think that the hardliners are going to win. They're going to crush the opposition. People power has limits. And I see a very, very dark, dark short-term future.
Mm-hmm. Is that the way you see it, Jim McCormick?
I guess I'll disagree with Stefan a little bit. I think that, you know, the sentiment is so strong and the real solution to Ukraine's economic problems are not with Russia. They're with the EU, with the one caveat, of course, if the EU can sort of make a rebound, but I think it can. But there really is, I think, sufficient populace in favor of moving to the east, to the west, not to the east, that we'll see over time. I take a little more optimistic view than mm-hmm. Stefan here.
Very unrealistic, I must add. the hardliners don't mess around. They jail people they don't like. They have jailed this other woman who was prime minister for trumped-up charges. They've divided the opposition. These are tough Soviet people. They're not subject to, you know, they're more like the president of Syria. And you know that President Assad is not giving in to people power, which is very clearly visible in Syria as well. They'll roll tanks over them. I can guarantee it.
Stephen Schmidt and Jim McCormick, before we go to a break in about 5 minutes, I wanted to get to one more area of international interest, Iran. Of course, that's been in the news for several weeks. But the nuclear deal between Iran and six world powers facing its first test this weekend. Inspectors for the International Atomic Energy Agency due to make a long-delayed visit to this nuclear reactor in Iran that could produce plutonium. It's in a place called Iraq, if I'm pronouncing it, A-R-A-K, a special concern because plutonium, of course, can be used in a nuclear bomb. And under last month's accord, Iran promised to allow those inspections. Officials on both sides say that they are committed to this nuclear deal. Stefan, let me start with you on this one. How big of a challenge will it be able to be to keep this on track, this deal?
If you're the state of Israel, you know that it's going to fail. you are certain that the Iranians are going to weasel out of it, that they are going to give up just enough to get the sanctions lifted, that they're going to continue developing various things, because whether they admit to it or not, it looks like their long-term objective is to have a military nuclear capability of some sort. And the Iranians are very tough. They're tough negotiators, and they're hurting because of the sanctions right now. But there's a lot of pessimism on some part. Others, and I must say, you caught me on the day when it's foggy, rainy, and cold out, and I guess I'm the pessimist today on this panel. I see it as very difficult. And you can ask the Congress what they think, and a lot of members of Congress are also very skeptical that this is actually a doable agreement and that the Iranians will comply with it.
Is it a partisan issue, the disagreement?
To some extent, it's a partisan issue because it's Kerry and the Obama administration and the Obama State Department who negotiated this deal. And in the United States, everything is a partisan issue in 2013. So, yes, it's partly
a partisan
issue.
Once it gets attached to President Obama, it becomes a partisan issue, is what you're saying.
That's absolutely correct.
Jim McCormick, this then is not seen, or do you see it as a foreign policy success for President Obama to negotiate this with John Kerry's help and along with the five other world powers?
I think we really have to wait to see if after 6 months there really is movement in terms of a permanent agreement here. The agreement actually says, of course, that they can renew it for 6 months or any length of time before a permanent agreement. I suspect that's more likely to be the case than completing the deal in 6 months. But if I could get back to what you asked about the Iraq plutonium facility, I think overall, you know, there's really some positiveness in this agreement. The Iranians have agreed to go to the so-called additional protocol from the NPT, something they frankly did not live up to in the early part of this century when they said they would do that. Mm-hmm. But this has been put back into place. I think the one problem with Iraq, the plutonium facility, is not dismantlement. There's only the stopping of construction of it. Suspending of construction. And, you know, it obviously delays moving towards plutonium production here, but it does not really reverse it. And I think that and all of these components of the agreements, it's really not any kind of dismantlement. It's mainly freezing in place. Mm-hmm. And I think the Iranians did get, and I think it's very clear from the agreement, which is only a four-page agreement, which is available online, they did get it at least at two different places that they could enrich uranium. And that is a very major concession. And I think there's no doubt, you know, American politicians may squabble about whether they really agreed to that. I think what it says on the paper is they really did agree to allow enrichment of uranium for the Iranians. And even it says the final agreement is going to have some component of enrichment. So that's a very, very major concession, and it is even more problematic when you also consider that the one nuclear energy facility that Iraq has at the present time has an agreement. It was done by Russia and has an agreement that providing for nuclear fuels. So what do they need to enrich uranium for?
Okay. Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University. Stephen Schmidt, university professor of political science at Iowa State University, our analysts on this Politics Wednesday. When we come back, we'll turn our view to domestic politics. Yesterday, President Obama saying his signature health care reform law is going nowhere as long as he's in office. We'll talk about that when we come back. Also, the almost do-nothing Congress. We'll measure it against other previous Congresses talk about something called de-evolution when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday, as Stephen Schmidt has pointed out a couple of times, it's a gloomy, rainy, cold day. And, well, we're making it either brighter or or gloomier, depending on what topic we're talking about. Jim McCormick with us, also at Iowa State University, along with Stefan Schmidt. We're turning our focus to domestic politics this half hour. A little later in the half hour, we want to talk about this fascinating idea that, Stefan, this is a friend of yours, Colin Woodward, a reporter at the Portland Press-Herald, author of several books put forward, feeds off or is related to an op-ed piece you had in the Des Moines Register this week. And I'm mentioning it now because I would like to have listeners go to our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or the Twitter page at IPR Talk to find this 11 nations map. And it is broken up, North America broken up neatly, according to Colin Woodward, into 11 separate nation states where dominant cultures explain our voting behaviors, attitudes, everything from social issues to the role of government. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. But I've been staring at this map all morning, Stefan. And I'm sure you've stared at it for a long time. But first, before we get to that, let's talk about the latest developments in the Affordable Care Act. Yesterday, President Obama said his signature health care reform law is going nowhere as long as he's in office, and he'll spend the remainder of his presidency fighting to make it work if necessary. Over the weekend, a self-imposed deadline was met for making the website healthcare.gov work better. He says his administration's focus had to shift to nonstop error fixing. And now he's making the case that the website is much better and that the law itself is working and necessary.
You know, the bottom line is this law is working and will work into the future. People want the financial stability of health insurance. And we're going to keep on working to fix whatever problems come up in any startup, any launch of a project this big that has an impact on 1/6 of our economy, whatever comes up, we're going to just fix it. Because we know that the ultimate goal, the ultimate aim, is to make sure that people have basic security and the foundation for the good health that they need. Now, we may never satisfy the law's opponents. I think that's fair to say. Some of them are rooting for this law to fail. That's not my opinion, by the way. They say it pretty explicitly. Some have already convinced themselves that the law has failed, regardless of the evidence. But I would advise them to check with the people who are here today and the people that they represent all across the country whose lives have been changed for the better by the Affordable Care Act.
President Obama yesterday at the White House, he went on to list some individual success stories of people who he says have benefited from the law. Stefan Schmidt, now that healthcare.gov is working reasonably well, how much of a fight will Republicans still give the White House in this? The phrase there, rooting to fail, and he said that's not his opinion.
Well, the website is only the window into a gigantic Rube Goldberg-like healthcare disaster that most people think will be very, very difficult to make work. The fact that the website works doesn't mean anything about the back end of the website, which is whether or not the information that people are punching in is being properly aggregated, whether information is correctly being collected from the Internal Revenue Service, Social Security, and other federal agencies to then incorporate into the essentially the assessment of costs of policies that people are going to sign up for, because the people need to understand how much their policy based on their income, their age, the zip code that they put in is going to be subsidized in order to know which policies they're eligible for. Mm-hmm. There is no proof at all that the insurance companies are receiving the correct information after people log in and can issue policies to the people who have logged in. This is baloney being sliced up and served to the public. It's a PR job. We will not have any idea how this is going to come out until months from now, perhaps a year or more from now, when we see whether all of this is actually working.
Mm-hmm.
This is a much bigger, complex, and unlikely scenario than the Iranian nuclear deal that we were just talking about. the fact that the website works is, in some respects at least, irrelevant because there have been too many questions raised by people, for example, about the security of the highly confidential information that people are putting into that site, which is, you know, their income, their social security number, and other information that is extremely valuable to identity thieves and others.
Okay.
I know I'm a pessimist today on almost everything.
Oh, yes.
The only thing I'm optimistic about is that it looks like we're not going to get the enormous, horrible weather that is hitting other parts of the Midwest. That's very good news, and I'm very happy.
Well, you have to look. You have to change it from politics to find any brighter picture. Jim McCormick, can we look to you for a somewhat brighter picture, or do you share Stefan's view?
Well, I think there's going to really be competing stories here by both Republicans and Democrats, by the president. The report is that the president is going on a kind of a campaign-style promotion of health care. I'm not sure about the timing, given that the holidays are coming up and, you know, how much attention the public will be paying to that. I think the other real problem is, and Stefan alluded to it, is really getting hard data on what is occurring with the website, how many people are actually signing up. And, you know, we have seen all kinds of various numbers, one way or the other. And I think, you know, that is going to be sort of the ticket to look at to see how well it's working or if it is in fact failing. One thing I wanted to comment on what the president said, and I thought it was interesting, that he said, we will make fixes in this law. We won't repeal it. I mean, he was clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering, you know, if in fact the real hard data that the White House has shows that it's not going as well, will they then at that juncture be willing to make some changes, particularly as we get into next summer and in the next fall with the elections on the horizon?
And I wonder if that's a cue for Republicans, who are no longer talking about repeal of ACA, to pick off parts of it, opening the door to take pot shots at parts of it.
That's what supposedly Paul Ryan is going to announce here maybe early January, at least the reports that I've seen. They're going to have pieces of it, you know, ensuring that if you have a pre-existing condition, you can get health insurance. If you have a health insurance plan that you're happy with, you can maintain that. So sort of cherry pick, if you will. Areas where there is popular support and also where the administration will have a difficult time, opposing here, in fact, and maybe endorsing. So I think that's more likely the picture than, you know, all out, going to the mat, if you will, I guess, to use that imagery of repealing or keeping the law in its present
but
state.
But can I make a quick comment, please? If you take an aircraft carrier and you want to basically destroy the aircraft carrier, you don't have to sink it. You can take away its radar. You can take away its cruise missiles. You can take away its landing deck and say, well, we still have an aircraft carrier. We're just modifying it.
But
if we do all the things that McCormick is talking about, it's not the Affordable Health Care Act at all.
But what it is is
a bunch of little reforms here and there. And the Republicans are going to win big in 2014. Today, the numbers are horrible for the Democrats. And if the Republicans regain the House with as many as they have now, and God forbid for Obama regain the Senate, they're going to do everything they can to cut funding for all the things that are necessary to actually make the Affordable Health Care Act system work. Because if you cut the staff of all these different agencies that have to service the Affordable Health Care Act, which they may very well be able to do, It can't function.
Okay. Let's talk about another couple of items of domestic policy. But the passion is certainly there on both sides to talk about that. And the next chapters are developing as we speak in the implementation of the ACA. But let's talk about the end of this legislative session. Only a handful of remaining legislative days on the calendar for this Congress. And it's on track to go down as one of the most unproductive in modern history. According to Thomas, this legislative tracking service, this Congress has passed just 52 public laws since it gaveled into session in January. In contrast, at this point in George W. Bush's second term, at this time, 113 bills had been enacted into law. according to numbers crunched by the Pew Research Center. So it's no wonder that the public gives Congress single-digit approval rating. Both of your views, starting with you, Jim, what does it mean for our politics, our country, for the midterm elections, that we have this very unproductive Congress? Does it matter the number of new laws passed?
Well, certainly Tea Party members would be excited about this. I mean, they would say that the few number of bills passed, the better for the country as a whole. I think you really have to look at what the composition of those bills are, and that's sort of looking at the numbers, why it's a problem. There are some outstanding bills that have not been done. The one obviously most germane to Iowa is the farm bill. That farm bill that not only has languished, didn't meet a deadline last year, and it looks like it may not meet a deadline this year, although I noticed that Senator Grassley even said as recently as yesterday that he was optimistic that something would still get done within this calendar year. So I think I would focus less on the total number of bills and instead look at the ones that were done or not done. There are certainly ones that are not been addressed that could be addressed, like the immigration bill. Mm-hmm. I frankly expect that next year that some kind of an immigration bill will be passed because it benefits both Democrats and Republicans in sort of different ways going into the 2014 election. So I think I guess my emphasis would be less on looking at the total number of bills and look at what bills have been passed and what bills have not been passed. The real critical one, of course, and we haven't even mentioned it yet today, is, you know, we got another debt ceiling bill coming up here early in the new year. And that also is something that obviously has to be addressed.
Stephen Schmidt, how worried are you when you see 52 public laws enacted by Congress in this session?
Well, there isn't any doubt among any analysts who are looking at this Congress that it is the least productive Congress since 1947. And it doesn't matter if you look at specific laws or how many laws. This has been a completely paralyzed legislative session in which almost nothing has gone through that is of great significance. The Affordable Health Care Act, whether you like it or not, was not passed by this Congress. It was passed by a Congress in which the Democrats controlled the House and Senate. And the piddly little things that have been passed that are in that list of 52 or whatever the number is today, I mean, some of those are pretty irrelevant little acts where the Tea Party and the Democrats could agree on something. You can imagine that it's pretty irrelevant stuff. I mean, they decided to extend the prohibition on plastic guns with 90% plastic and 10% metal, I think. But then they managed to get into a giant fight over amending that so that it includes the new plastic guns that you can now print at home. So even on that one, where they actually renewed a law that was expiring on plastic guns, they couldn't agree to bring it up to date to the 21st century. And so the National Rifle Association is mounting a massive campaign to say no to any changes in that law. So in the future, people will be able to carry plastic guns that they made on their digital 3D printers at home onto an airplane or into a building. We are paralyzed, and this Congress is paralyzed. And that's why Americans are getting frustrated and turning to other levels of government, the mayors and the cities and the governors and the state level. And people are saying, let's try to solve some of these problems there.
Right.
Because the federal government is basically dysfunctional.
And this is the thrust of a Des Moines Register op-ed that you wrote for this week. Titled,
oh, is it really?
When D.C. stalls, power flows downward and uncertainty rises. Stephen Schmidt, give us some examples of this vacuum, I think a vacuum you call it, that is being starting to be occupied by states and cities taking matters into their own hands.
Well, you know, this country was once a very loose coalition of states under the first constitution of the United States called the Articles of Confederation. That was the first constitution. And states basically did most of the stuff, and they delegated a few things to the national government, the federal government. And that's how they ran things. And when that wasn't working very well, we went back to Philadelphia and rewrote the articles and came up with a constitution that strengthened the federal government. But when the federal government fails to carry out the responsibilities that it has under the Constitution, I'll give you an example, immigration. The federal government neglected border control for decades. The borders of the United States were to be protected by the federal government. Illegal immigrants were not to be permitted in over the border. People entering the country and staying over their tourist or student visas were not to be allowed to stay in. But the federal government did nothing. So what happened? Well, we know what happened. Arizona and Alabama and other states began to pass their own immigration laws and began to enforce very strict immigration rules because the federal government wasn't doing it. The same is happening now. A lot of states and even cities think that the minimum wage is too low, that people making minimum wage become welfare burdens automatically because they cannot pay for their rent and their heat and their food and their clothing and basic necessities. So they go on welfare to supplement it. They become Medicaid patients and cost the taxpayers a lot because corporations are basically shifting the cost of their workforce to the taxpayers. So a lot of cities and even states are considering and, in fact, raising local minimum wages. Cities and states are doing other things with many other things we could talk about, mm-hmm. you know, drug reform and, you know, the whole issue of the states being frustrated about laws that prohibit marijuana and cause jails to be bulging with people who have violated marijuana laws. So states are passing constitutional amendments and laws and things that legalize various levels of marijuana use because they don't want to wait for the federal government to do it. And I think unless the federal government lives up to the expectation of the public and performs, we are going to see a lot of devolution, not necessarily states actually leaving the union. I mean, in
so,
the
so
article,
devolution, you know, is just means a looser federation.
Exactly. It means things will simply migrate from the federal government down to lower levels of government. We have 90,000 different governments in the United States. I think it's 96,270 or something in my mm-hmm. textbook. That's municipal governments and school districts and states and counties and so on. If the federal government doesn't do things, people have become impatient and will no longer wait for it. And so I think it's possible that we will see some of that happening. The dramatic things, you know, like California and the West Coast deciding to separate and become a separate nation is not as likely, even though, yep. you know, there have been people like Sarah Palin's husband was a member of a separatist party that wanted Alaska to become a separate country. And the governor of Texas himself at one point in a speech was very frustrated and said, maybe Texas needs to become, you know, the Republic of Texas again. Okay. I don't think that's likely.
Stefan, we're running out of time. I wanted you to tie that quickly into the map that we have a link to on our Facebook page. This is Colin Woodward, separating North America into a very provocative political map. Tell us what he did there and why.
American Nations, a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. That's the title of his book. I talked to him the other day. He's a friend of mine. He also has written some books about coastal and environmental issues, so I've known him for years. And he said, look, I wrote this book. It rolled out. Nothing happened. Then the Washington Post published the map of the 11 nations that you have put on your website, and it exploded. We're trying to book him at Iowa State. We can't get him because he's so booked up. He thinks that there are these historic regional, migrational, economic, and regional cultural and other interests that have come together that have created essentially clusters of people with different values that define them, and that it is not a United States, but it is more like a quilt that's sort of stitched together in some parts of the country. Even states are mm-hmm. divided. California, you know, the coastal area of California is one culture and the other is called the left coast.
Most of Iowa, as far as I can see, is in the Midlands, maybe a little bit of northern Iowa in something called Yankeedom. Have a look at that map. We're running out of time, Stefan.
It's fascinating.
I wanted to get a quick word from each of you, very quick, 30 seconds each. What do you see in 2014? Because we're coming up on that year. What will stand out in 2014 when you look in the crystal ball, Jim McCormick?
Well, I think we're going to have probably a
turnout of the for the election at a lower level than we've had in previous years, because I think because politics has become so poisonous, if you will, I think that's actually going to lead to less turnout here. I'm not, you know, the sort of conventional wisdom is that opposition candidates will do much better.
Okay.
The public really still loves their incumbents. Members of Congress. So okay. I would be cautious about that.
Stephen Schmidt, what will we remember 2014 for quickly?
I am afraid to say for the Democrats, a year when the usual rule that the out party that's not in the White House gets clobbered is going to happen. I think Obamacare will linger as a tremendous, tremendous problem for the Democrats.
Stephen Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jim McCormick, Professor and Chair of Political Science at ISU. Gentlemen, thank you for coming into our studio today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Wraps up Politics Wednesday today. Joining me in the studio, Charity Nebbe, 10 o'clock tomorrow. What are we going to listen to, Charity?
Well, a little over a year ago, James Autry, who's a well-known poet and writer in the Des Moines area, published a book called Choosing Gratitude that really has been changing a lot of people's
wonderful
lives.
Book. Wonderful man.
Yes. Well, he's coming back because he and his wife, Sally Peterson, have co-authored a follow-up book called Choosing Gratitude 365 Days a Year. So tomorrow I will talk with them both.
Okay, Charity Nebbe, talk of Iowa tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Tomorrow on this program at noon, we'll talk about the efforts to get every Iowan tested for HIV, preventions, measures, treatment, and what it means to have HIV and AIDS in 2013. Thanks to Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton, also Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.